Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Howdy, y'all.
Why did I say that? That's stupid.
Today's a day, a very special day. I'm Dude. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I got Andy and Don with me. How are you gentlemen doing, Andy? You ready to get out your shopping satchel or whatever you're calling it this week?
This is how we celebrate holidays in America. We go shopping.
Yes. We make up holidays specifically for shopping.
For shopping, yeah. I do think that's important, though, to support your local record store, and I'm all about it. I'm glad to be here to do that a little bit today. How are you doing over there, Don?
Good, but you know we should hurry up and record, because after this, I got to get in line, camping out. Right. Got to get that limited edition of the Cure.
There you go. Only 3,000 available across the nation. Or the world. All right. So yes, this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and we have a great show for you today. We'll be talking about three albums that are having a special release on Record Store Day. Donnie's going to ask us a deep question. The deeper, the better. Oh, gross. Then we're going to have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. Then we're going to spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. But this week, let's celebrate. It's Record Store Day.
That's what I'm talking about!
Record Store Day 2025, which is April 12th, promises to be a celebration of music history and artistry, featuring an eclectic mix of exclusive vinyl releases from legendary artists and contemporary favorites. This year's lineup highlights the enduring appeal of vinyl across genres and generations. And today, each of us will discuss an album that will receive a special release on Record Store Day.
Yeah, I mean, I've been attending Record Store Day for a long time. I can't remember how far back, but it goes back pretty far, at least 10 years, I think. And it's fun. And now they're starting to expand. I mean, it's not just vinyl. They're doing CDs now. Some of these have CD releases. I think, there's some idea out there that physical media needs to survive, and CDs are a good way to do that as well. So, yeah, it's exciting. Big list, lots of special live things and demos and outtakes and things are available, but we were looking for some full albums to discuss. So what other albums did you consider before making your final choice from Record Store Day?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting selection of records they have from really all eras and genres and styles of music. The one that I was curious to see or surprised to see is a 10-year anniversary of this group that really just existed for a moment called Sex Witch. Mm. It had a self-titled debut in 2015.
Now, is that like a sandwich? Mm. Like a manwich?
There's some meat involved. Oh, jeez. Now, this is we've talked about the group Bat for Lashes, the primary creative force there, Natasha Khan, and members of the English rock group Toy got together to put out some kind of like groove-based, but it had like this kind of Middle Eastern flair to it, kind of sexy record. Mm. It's really short. I almost went with it, but yeah. I think we had enough sexy kind of records on the show today. So,
all right. You say so.
What did you come across, Don?
Well, I actually had a lot of fun kind of going down the list, and I ended up hearing a bunch of artists I hadn't heard of before. But one I did strongly consider was from the group Belly. Their second album from 1995 called King. Belly was Tanya Donnelly of Throwing Muses. Their first record had a lot of success, had that song Feed the Tree that was, featured on MTV. But this is a, pretty solid album, a little more kind of rock oriented than the first one. But it's going to be reissued for the first time since it came out in 1995 on a green vinyl.
Mm. Fancy.
How about you, dude?
So I was close on this Gil Scott-Heron album, Moving Target, from 1982. It was his 12th studio album. He's an American spoken word poet and blues musician. The album blends that signature jazzy R&B and funk grooves, so it's very funk forward.
Yeah, pretty funky, yeah. It's the 70s, yeah.
Some reggae influences, songs like Fastlane, Washington, D.C., and then nearly 10-minute spoken word piece at the end, Black History, The World. A really fun listen. I've heard his name. I've never dug into his music before. Supposedly not his best, according to the experts, but I did enjoy it. And it has been out of print and completely unavailable for years. But this Record Store Day release includes a bright red colored vinyl.
Ooh, nice.
All right, so enough about what we almost picked. Let's move on to our choices.
You choose me?
All right, for my Record Store Day 2025 selection, we're talking about Thelonious Monk and his 1957 album Mulligan Meets Monk. So this is Monk's 14-ish studio album, features heavily Jerry Mulligan on baritone saxophone. He was pretty well known at the time for his kind of airy, cool style jazz. He's from California. He played most prominently with Chet Baker in a quartet in the early 50s. He also played with the likes of like Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, Count Basie. A lot of, you know, well-known artists in that jazz space in the 50s.
Now, there were a lot of different takes of these songs. Now, is that where the term take a mulligan came from, where you redo something?
I think so. Yeah, this is the origin story.
Wow, right, it's been discovered here by the album nerds. Congratulations to us.
This release, this Mulligan Meets Monk special release record store day, includes the rare mono mix of the album, as well as a bunch of extra takes on some of the tracks here.
Those mulligans.
Mulligans, you may call them. It's on 180 gram vinyl, so I'm sure it'll sound great. Let's jump in here and play the opening cut. This is Round Midnight.
I rarely have the urge, but this album made me want to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, right? Something cool about the whole thing, for sure. So that's a Monk original composition there, probably his most well-known composition, definitely appears on a lot of his albums over the years. I think Monk, you know, this is kind of like, he's still pretty early on in his career here, and I think he does taking a lot of chances on this record. I found that aspect fairly interesting. Yeah, so you can hear a little bit of Mulligan and Monk playing together there, kind of keeping up with each other, I would say. There's no drums or bass on that track, but they are featured throughout the album here. My clickbait headline for Mulligan Meets Monk is Monk and Mulligan move the margins to meet in the middle.
Marvelous.
Love it. I think they call that alliteration.
Yes, they do.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this is kind of an odd pairing. So Monk, very experimental, known for like the kind of bop style, very creative approach, a little bit left field, I would say, in the jazz space. Mulligan, kind of the opposite side of that, very softer style, a little more laid back, a little more airy in his play style on the sax there. But they make this album work, I think, generally. They meet together somewhere in the middle, and, you know, Monk maybe tones things down a little bit, and Mulligan maybe speeds things up a little to keep up with Thelonious. But I think generally they both do a good job in finding some common ground, and I think this is a pretty solid release.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the juxtaposition of those styles, because one gets a little energy infused, and then, you know, the bop kind of gets sanded down a little bit, so you can have these highs and lows and not just nothing but highs. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, I think. Yeah, they kind of balance each other out, I would say, in a nice way.
Yin-yang.
The yin and yang of it all. Let's jump in here and play one of those cuts that is a little bit more on the Mulligan side of things. This is called Decidedly.
Decidedly is composed by Jerry Mulligan. It's a reinterpretation of Charlie Shaver's composition Undecided. So he's kind of restructuring the tune, maintaining the recognizable elements of it. I think it's cool. It's like I saw this term a lot, you know, when reading about this record, musical dialogue.
Yeah.
So particularly this song, you know, I think there's a lot of back and forth, you know, a dialogue between those two instruments. And, you know, I think it kind of helped me understand the two distinct worlds that that these artists come from, you know, the difference between bebop and cool jazz. But the piano is used more as like a percussive instrument, and it's it's kind of bringing the chaos at mm-hmm. times, and the melody oh, yeah. is usually coming from the, you know, the saxophone. So that's sort of, you know, like what keeps me grounded or something, and, you know, yeah. keeps me on track with these records.
Well, it's because you're sinking into that groove, and then there's the bling lao pianos, yeah. you know, kind of yeah. wake you up a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, Monk almost sounds like he's like playing with him a little bit on that track. Like he's just kind of throwing little wrinkles at him, like, oh, yeah. what are you going to do here? What are you going to do there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, you know, it's interesting the way he, I mean, he'll just play seemingly like random notes, you know, or random combination. You're like, oh, you know, what is that? That's nothing. Right. And then, but then like he always sort of comes back to something that makes sense and that's actually kind of impressive, like some role on the piano. It's like, ooh. Anyway, my clickbait headline for Mulligan Meets Monk is Cool Jazz Hero Checks Into Bebop Monastery. Yeah, it's a monastery because he's a monk.
Yeah, yeah, that's oh, right. Right. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
He didn't have that tragic monk haircut, did he?
I don't think so.
Okay.
The bald spot thing.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this record. You know, I'm not sure exactly where it stands in jazz history because I know next to nothing about it. But, you know, I like the baritone sax as an instrument. You know, that range is just really pleasing to the ear. And, you know, again, the combination of those two genres, you know, seems to work pretty well here. Some people suggested that, you know, they were kind of going back to more of like a swing style.
Yeah.
I mean, their origins are there, you know, so they kind of found that common ground and they built from there. So
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, things do pick up the pace at times here, especially the second cut, Reimanning. Mulligan comes in and plays a freaking scorching solo on that track. It was really kind of surprising to hear him play at that pace. But yeah, when they do get going, they do get into some interesting jams here, and things do get pretty lively at times. One of those more lively tracks here is another pretty popular Monk song. This is Straight No Chaser.
All right, so Straight No Chaser is another Monk composition. 12-bar blues showcases that innovative approach to melody and rhythm. And this has the full quartet, Mulligan on baritone saxophone, of course, Wilbur Ware on double bass, and Shadow Wilson on drums, joining in with Thelonious there. So this particular version of this is characterized by that relaxed mid-tempo groove, and the angular piano style and the saxophone lines just really work together here. Again, none of us are jazz aficionados per se, or we're more people learning to really enjoy it by these conversations we have on the show. The title, Straight No Chaser, just sounds like a hard day at work, you know, back in the 50s. I picture, you know, the suits and the hats and showing up at this bar and having a shot of whiskey and enjoying some jazz music to unwind, and this just paints that picture so well with the music, and then a couple, you know, three words for the song title that helps set that tone.
I feel like Mulligan is kind of the chaser here.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you get the hard shot of jazz.
Yeah, I think in many ways Mulligan is trying to kind of keep up with the pace that the Monk sets here.
He's the sips of water you have after you've had too much to drink.
Yeah, kind of bring you back to some level of cognition.
All right, so my clickbait headline to describe Mulligan Meets Monk: bebop meets cool jazz. When Monk meets Mulligan, improved opposites attract. So, you know, Paula Abdul has a lot to thank these guys for. Her and MC Scat Cat could have never gotten along if it weren't for MC Scat Cat. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go check out Opposites Attract by Paula Abdul and a cartoon cat. Anyway, yeah, I really enjoyed this. I don't think I've listened to enough Thelonious Monk. I certainly was not familiar with Mulligan. Whenever we do these shows where these jazz albums get included, I do spend time listening to jazz records randomly. But I had a thought, like, I enjoy the book series Bosch. He's a detective and he's a huge jazz fan. And in all the books featured, he talks about different tracks he's listening to and what album and why. So I've been digging around. There are playlists. So I think I'm going to go listen to some Bosch playlists and approach it that way.
I want to get into it. Yep. I think that's cool.
Find a way, because it's worth it. I know it's scary. Jazz is scary for people that didn't grow up with it.
Probably not as scary as being a police officer.
Well, being a police officer isn't scary when you've got jazz by your side.
Interesting little fun fact here. I read reportedly the original intent on this record was to have the duo play with a large big band, as was the customary in this time period.
Glad they didn't.
Yeah, they scrapped that after these initial sessions were so good. They just were like, yeah, I think this is the album. I agree. I think that was a good decision. So if you're looking for some really interesting kind of two worlds colliding in the jazz space in the mid-50s, Mulligan Meets Monk, I think, is an excellent selection, and it's available for purchase at your record store today.
Before we continue our shopping spree for Record Store Day, why don't we hear a little bit from our friends over at the Worst Podcast on Mars.
I'm Amanda, and that's Evan. Say hi, Evan.
Hi, Evan.
And we're the hosts of the Worst Podcast on Mars. This is the podcast that talks music. And on Fridays, we work our way through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of 200 definitive albums. I do a bunch of research trying to figure out why it's on this list. And on Tuesdays, we do smaller episodes that are not part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list. And Evan, well, he just literally shows up. So if that's what you're into, please find us on Apple Music or Spotify.
But not Mars. Yet.
Okay, my pick for Record Store Day 2025 comes from Hindu Love Gods, their self-titled and only album from October 1990. The album hasn't been reissued on vinyl since it first came out, and this will be on 180-gram black vinyl. Well, I'll just give you the backstory. So Warren Zevon,
yep,
right, who you've probably heard of.
Werewolves of London.
Ow. Yep.
Ow.
ow. He hired Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Bill Berry of R.A.M. to play on his Sentimental Hygiene album, which came out in 1987.
Great name.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, they wrapped up recording early, you know, kind of like a drunken late night session. Zevon just sort of led them through a bunch of, you know, blues and rock standards, you know, by people like Robert Johnson and Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters. Yeah, they just had fun kind of, you know, rocking out to these tunes. It was never intended for release, but Zevon's manager in 1990, Andrew Slater, chose to publish the recordings without consulting anybody. And so wow. Here we have Hindu Love Gods. So let's hear a cut. This is Junko Pardner.
Junko Pardner, he was loaded as he could be.
Junko Pardner is a blues song, sometimes with the subtitle Worthless Man, credited to record executive Bob Shad, and was first recorded by James Wayne in 1951. It was supposedly directly inspired by Junker's Blues by Willie Hall. Now, the liner notes to Dr. John's Gumbo, which was his 1972 album, where the song also appears on, says it's the anthem of the dopers, the whores, the pimps, the cons. It was a song they sang in Angola, the state prison farm. It's actually mentioned in the lyrics. And the rhythm was even known as the jailbird beat.
Okay.
Huh. Interesting.
I mean, it does kind of sound like something that would have fit in for like Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison performances and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And this, you know, this rendition retains that blues structure, but definitely a raw, just rock oriented arrangement. Just like the whole album feels pretty just spontaneous. So my clickbait headline for Hindu Love Gods is, what's the frequency, Warren? R.E.M. channels a blues rock dream.
What's the frequency, Warren?
I like that. That's nice.
This is just a cool find, you know? Like, I actually hadn't heard about it until about 10 or 15 years ago. A friend turned me onto it. But it just feels like this sort of non-profound, but just this studio magic that occurred, you know, between, you know, just four guys having fun, you know, playing old rock tunes. You know, I appreciate it because it doesn't sound like R.E.M.
No.
You know, like when Peter Buck guests on other people's records, it always sounds like Peter Buck, you know, kind of that jangly, you know, signature style. And this, you wouldn't know this is R.E.M.
No, you really wouldn't.
Yeah, and I think Warren Zevon just really shines as a rock frontman in this, and maybe because the ironic and clever lyrics that he comes up with, you know, there's none of that. These are just, you know, sort of just classic lyrics, and he really just does them well. Well, let's hear you know, one of the non blue standards from the record. This is Raspberry Beret.
That's just such a garage rock kind of version of that. It just sounds like a band hashing it out, which is what it is. And that's what's cool about this. So I think it should be Raspberry Beret because of the raspy vocal style of Warren Zevon.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, really, you know, pronounced that first part of the word. Yeah, so obviously that song was originally written and performed by Prince and the Revolution, released on the 1985 album Around the World in a Day. This one is playful, it's jammy, and apparently this cover reached number 23 on Billboard's Modern Rock Track chart in December of 1990. I had heard of this as like this mythical project that happened. I never heard any of the recordings until now. My clickbait headline, he described the album, Hindu Love Gods Returns. The 1990 cult album gets a Record Store Day revival. I think that that's what Record Store Day is best at. Yeah, you can get some cool demos and different things like that or live performances, but the more exciting thing to me is stuff like this that gets unearthed and made available for the first time in a long time. It's sort of that magic around this secret project that never was supposed to be makes it even more special. So
yeah,
I may see if I can get my hands on a copy of this. They just sound like a perfect band, like at a beer garden or something, you know?
Definitely some beer involved with this. Yeah. I would
say. Seems like they just wanted to try anything and everything. I think sometimes you don't have that freedom when you're in a known band. You've got to sound a certain way. This must have been a nice relief and release. Crosscut saw Albert King, love Albert King, and it makes perfect sense that Zevon would want to pay homage to him. So, yeah, I enjoyed this quite a bit. Like I said, if I find it and it's reasonably priced, I'll pick it up.
All right, well, let's hear more. Here's Wang Dang Doodle. We gonna jump and shout till daylight. We gonna pitch a Wang Dang
Doodle all night long. We gonna pitch a Wang Dang Doodle. Wang Dang Doodle was originally written by Willie Dixon. First recorded by Helen Wolf. Man, the band is really playing at a blistering pace on that track. I mean, really, throughout the whole record here, I feel like the group there is just really firing on all cylinders. My clickbait headline for Hindu Love Gods is, and the record executive gods declared, let there be stipe, and it was good. You know, I had a lot of fun with this. I had zero expectations going into it. Didn't really know who was involved. And it has a very fun, loose, live quality to it, which I appreciate. I like that they're picking kind of like, you know, a good, interesting mix of blues songs here. Some might recognize, some I didn't. I think there's moments where this goes into like campiness, where it's like sort of an impression of a blues singer. And I really feel like it loses me at those times. It almost sounds like he's forcing some of the blues inflections and, you know, the stank you might put on your voice when you're trying to declare your bluesiness. I don't know. It felt like a little bit of a novelty, especially Raspberry Beret. Oh, my gosh. I thought that was just one of the worst covers of that I've ever heard.
Really? I like it.
Well, I think the spirit of it was that they're just fucking around, right? They're just...
Yeah.
This wasn't, like Don said, not meant or groomed to be an album. These were guys playing, you know, like playing in the garage, just goofing around with songs, probably laughing and overdone, if there's overdone affectations, just for the fun of it, like, you know, being bluesy and stuff. So
Well, it sounds like something you do if you had a few drinks and you were like, you know, just loose.
Yeah. It's like they got caught, you know, in a private moment, and that got turned into a record.
that part makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. But I don't know, Zevon's voice, I just don't think is really... I mean, he can do blues to some regard, but when he tried to do like Prince, I think he's just in a totally different ballpark.
I don't think he had the intention of slapping Prince in the face with a lacy glove to like do a duel over who does Raspberry Beret better. It's obviously, I think, just for fun.
Yeah, just for fun. Yeah. It's fun. It's fun, but doesn't mean I have to enjoy it.
I suppose you're right.
I was wondering about the group, the three musicians playing here. Were they together before this in some capacity, or were they still kind of becoming REM, or how did that transition work?
No, I mean, REM goes back to like, you know, 82 or 83.
Well, they were already together at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. So they were just on like a hiatus.
This is probably around the time they were recording Green, I would guess. So between Document and Green. So yeah, they were on the verge of, you know, finding real mainstream success.
Okay. So why wasn't Stipe playing with them at this point?
They were on a break.
We were on a break.
they were working musicians, right? And Warren Zevon, a known person, hired them to be his backing band for his 1987 album. So
this is a gig.
I think he just liked how they played, and it was just a job. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, and they already had a relationship because I think going back to 84, there are performances of Hindu Love Gods, you know, doing covers, and Warren Zevon appeared occasionally. So one way or another, they had some kind of personal relationship, and apparently he wanted them on his record.
Did they do anything together after this?
No. And I don't know if the fallout from having this stuff released kind of, you know, put a wedge in their relationship.
Gotcha.
But I think Warren Zevon kind of claims sort of ignorance on this, like, oh, it's my management who did it, you know, so.
Yeah.
Who knows? But I think they did sort of make up at some point.
Yeah. I mean, by 1990, REM was starting to really fire on all cylinders. So, hey, here's an REM project that Warren's done. You know, I get it.
Yeah. Like, REM was getting annoyed because they were getting, like, requests from the record label and stuff to promote it and, like, do interviews about it. And they didn't, you know, they had no interest in it. And then they were getting criticism from his management saying, hey, why won't you support? You're leaving your friend in the lurch. And, you know, so they were not happy about any of it.
That's kind of wild that they could release something without their consent. Like,
it must be because they were hired for the sessions. So it must be like anything that comes out of those sessions, you know, Zevon's people had the rights to, I guess. Okay. So here are the bluesy side of REM with Warren Zevon at the helm. It is the Hindu Love God self-titled album released in 1990.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time for Deep Questions by Don. So Record Store Day is kind of a celebration for people who love records and independent record stores. What other special interests deserve a day?
Well, I did a little research. There's a bunch of goofy-ass holidays that are already on the calendar. I thought I'd throw out a couple there. We're coming up on National Lost Sock Memorial Day.
Lost sock. Good God.
Lost sock. Yeah, you're supposed to get rid of all your orphaned socks on this day. There's National Bathtub Party Day, December 5th. And then my personal favorite, I think, is National Nothing Day on January 16th. I did not celebrate that this year, but I'm going to catch that next year for sure. I like that idea. I think I would try to promote more of doing nothing collectively days, like No Exercise Day, I think could be fun, maybe nationwide thing. No Pants Day, maybe I would be a proponent of that.
Well, for those of us that work from home, every day could be No Pants Day.
It's true. How about you, dude?
Yeah, so for me, I would say we should have a National Meat Store or Butcher Shop Day. And maybe there is, but there used to be neighborhood butcher shops around a lot more than they are now. But there's one I go to that's just down the street from the record store. And they just have, like, besides delicious cuts of meat and homemade, you know, beef sticks and sausages and all that stuff, they have a lot of interesting frozen items, interesting canned goods that you don't see at normal stores. Like, I bought a can of Spanish rice for a couple of bucks. So it had rice and like a tomato sauce with red and green peppers. And It tasted kind of like rice Getios. Like, it was not great, but still worth
a day to celebrate easily.
Worth the experiment. Yeah. I mean, because you can go to these shops and they're locally owned. So, you know, you're helping the community, but also it's just fun to get these interesting homemade items and weird spices and canned goods and things that you just don't see at the regular grocery store. And you get the personal touch, people friendly, helpful, know their stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
Go check out your local butcher shop.
I think I mentioned on the show before, Strat-O-Matic Baseball. It's almost like Dungeons and Dragons meets Major League Baseball. So you have like all your players, you have cards with all their attributes and stuff, and you basically roll dice to, you know, figure out who's going to win the game.
You're like, Jeter hits you with a bat at 5 impact.
Yeah. And I started playing it over Zoom, you know, during the pandemic. But like, I have nobody to play with, you know? So like the box, you know, the game just sits there. Right. So maybe there is one, but, you know, I think Strat-O-Matic Baseball Day would be good. And I can meet other nerds.
Do they is the gameplay like baseball game based, like, or are they beating up each other?
Oh yeah, you're playing a game.
Oh okay.
So it'll be Yankees versus Dodgers.
No wonder I don't have anyone to play with. If it was like Yankees beating up Dodgers and casting spells, then maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many hours does it take to play a game of that?
It depends. Once you, the more you play it, the faster it can go. Like, you know, as you're learning the game, and there's like different mode. You can do like a really simple version of the game, and then there's like really advanced ones where you're taking into effect like the ballpark and. Wow.
So yeah, if you do get a group of people together, I won't play it, but I will be the announcer. Just a bit outside. I'll do that kind of stuff.
That'd be good.
Nice. The play-by-play.
Yep.
Well, what other special interests deserve a day? Let us know. Hit us up on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
All right, so I'm going with The Sword, a band formed in 2003 in Austin, Texas by J.D. Cronise on vocals and guitar, Kyle Schutt on guitar, Brian Ritchie on bass, and Travis J. Stevens on drums. This band is kind of a lot of classic metal influences, Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, stoner rock, and doom metal elements. Gained a lot of attention in the underground metal scene in the early 2000s with their heavy riff-driven and thematic focus on mythology, the occult, and epic fantasy. Their first album, Age of Winters, went into Norse mythology. Their second one, Gods of Earth, dug into more polished sound, but more sword and sorcery themes. But we're going to be talking about the 2010 third album called Warp Riders, a sci-fi concept record about a cosmic journey and an epic battle for the fate of a doomed planet.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Kind of like Dune. You know, it's Dune-ish. Essentially, it's a planet that has a dark and a light side. It no longer rotates, and our hero, Aerith, from the planet Acheron, his mission is to fix that. So the 15th anniversary edition, coming out Record Store Day, remixed and remastered, housed in a stunning embossed mirror board jacket and pressed to a limited 4,000 copies worldwide, and it will be on a colored vinyl. So I'll be maybe picking that one up too. Again, depends on how much I have in my coin purse. Why don't we kick it off with the second track from the album, where the adventure really begins and our hero meets Trace Brujas.
Three beers?
Yeah, it's witches. Three witches you shall meet upon the path to your fate. So the lyrics to every song pretty much do hit parts of the story. It's not one of those, you know, it's like Operation Mindcrime.
Yeah, it's like you're reading a sci-fi novel, sort of, as you're listening to the album.
Yeah, and I think they did take some, the lead singer said that he took the idea of the Queensryche Operation Mindcrime, that was a full sci-fi-ish story, and applied in a more modern era here. So it's actually a pretty decent story. If you read along with what the parts of it are, you can hear it in the songs. I mean, the three witches, space witches, you know, pretty common stuff. you know, they're telling him what he has to do. They grant him a powerful weapon, urging him to find the Chronomancer, who's a time-wielding sorcerer who may hold the key to restoring Acheron. Yeah.
I was hoping there was a sex witch, but...
We covered that at the top of the show. None of these three are sex witches. Sorry, guys. My clickbait headline to describe the album, Warp Riders Turns 15, Revisiting the Sword's Galactic Saga, Proving Space Witches and Hard Rock Are a Match Made in the Stars.
Indeed.
I love the overall sound. Sometimes I could use some metal screaming or something. I could use a little, like the singer, he keeps it clean all the way through. I'd like it a little dirty here and there.
He does like kind of like a, just like a half... It's like a half singing, sort of half talking voice sort of approach.
There's usually some sort of chorus on his voice, I think.
Yeah. I like the overall sound. It's that there's some groovy desert metal, like Queens of the Stone Age vibes to this, I think, as well. But they used delay and reverb and phaser and flanger to make space type sounds from the guitars and the vocals, and it works. It sounds sci-fi. The cover looks like an 82 Atari game, you know, like Space Invaders or whatever. So
it really does.
All right, why don't we jump on into another one of the tracks and get to know the Chronomancer. It's called the Chronomancer 1, Hubris.
Alright, that is kind of our introduction to the Chronomancer character, who kind of sets our quest in motion here to restore balance to the planet. Simple lyrics, but impactful. I did find myself engaging with the story. I was kind of curious what was happening. It's a pretty creative story, honestly. Yeah. I don't know how much is pulled from other stories, but I found it pretty interesting.
I mean, it definitely has that Isaac Asimov kind of vibe to it, that era of sci-fi, that sort of 60s.
Yeah. Does. It works well with metal, I think. Mm-hmm. I kind of like the space aspect. It feels a little futuristic, but definitely harkens back to some of those old metal tropes here as well. My clickbait headline for Warp Riders. It's a bit of a song. So bear
all right, me. Andy's going to sing.
Riders of the Sword. Riders of the Sword. Into this world we're thrown, banished from our home. Creatures come and go. What happens next? No one really knows. I find this pretty interesting. I mean, I love the style of kind of like groove metal, a little bit of a stoner undercurrent here. It's definitely checks a lot of boxes for me, I would say, in terms of my personal taste. It's heavy, but it's not like overly heavy. It's not like in your face.
Yeah, it's not like someone making devil horns going metal. It's it's more in the music than in the full presentation.
Yeah, I would agree.
But yeah, you were right there. Riders of the Sword. The sword in this story is the spaceship that the Warp Riders, who Aerith joins up with for part of this adventure. So,
not a hip hop group.
That's Rough Riders. Rough Riders.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's an easy mistake to make, Don.
I think their strongest suit is the twin guitar attack here. Seems to be their trademark. It's pretty solid, I would say. You know, not like Hendrix level virtuosity, but pretty good stuff. So yeah, I did enjoy this overall. I found it pretty fun. It's not overly lengthy, but the story kind of keeps things moving.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of keeping moving, why don't we check out Lawless Lands?
So, after finding a mysterious orb and being set on his journey by one of the witches, Aerith must traverse these dangerous, lawless lands, which are basically the dark side of the planet. And he's, you know, constantly fending off attacks from, you know, who knows what. The orb guides him through this territory. He gets exhausted. You know, so this is that part of the story, and it's kind of building tension, you know, towards his eventual encounter with the Warp Riders and his arrival in Night City.
Night City.
So it's a tonal shift from the previous song, Tre Bruja, which had kind of like a faster paced, you know, sound. Lawless Lands is slower, kind of ominous sounding, but bluesy, you know, probably the bluesiest track, I think, on the record. But it's, you know, deliberate, this change of pace, you know, to sort of capture the dangerous, you know, ominous element, you know, entering this, you know, uncertain territory. That little rhythm part, that the dun 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 dun, sounds like Eye of the Tiger. Or
yes, it does.
Some moments from The Wall.
Oh, wait, we're going to bring the Pink Floyds into this, of course.
So my clickbait headline is, there is no dark side in Acheron, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark. That's actually, if you've listened to The Dark Side of the Moon, there's the guy saying that at the end.
Oh, my gosh. It's a planet, not a moon.
But it's got a dark side.
It is a dark side.
Yeah. Anyway, so I enjoyed this record a lot. I mean, it has all the elements of metal that I've kind of acquired a taste for. You know, it's got the thrash. Also, I mean, there's some southern rock sounding stuff here, I think. Some arena rock stuff. You know, it's kind of a mishmash. Yeah. I did listen to, you know, some songs from, you know, the previous records, and I do think I appreciate this approach more.
Yeah, it's kind of, at the time in particular, it was different to do more of a science fiction thing than, especially once they'd already done two albums that were more gods and goddesses and dragons and all that stuff.
Fantasy,
yeah,
fantasy.
Yeah. I appreciate that they, I don't know, I feel like when people do space age stories, then they rely on the synths, you know, to create those sounds, and they don't do that.
There's touches.
But it sounds like it's almost all like guitar effects, you know. It's a rock album, you know, with a narrative. And I guess I like that. I like the, you know, the simplicity of that. Yeah, and I actually like the vocal style. Reminds me of Tool a little bit. bit. Yeah. You know, again, there's not a lot of screaming or yelling, but it works. There's way more music than vocals on this on this album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, I actually enjoy a lot of the instrumental tracks. Like that opening cut is pretty epic.
Acheron.
And then I think the side two is like the dream of Arion or whatever.
Estrella's dream.
Oh, the Estrella's dream. Yeah, I mean, this is good stuff.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting too, the way the album ends with the night sky cried tears of fire. Aerith activates the orb. You know, I don't want to give too much away, but it's left kind of open. Like, does he sacrifice himself? Does he survive? Does, you know, is Acheron set right? You know, it leaves it to the listener.
Yeah. It does feel a little unresolved.
Yeah. But, I guess there's a bonus track that was on like the Japanese version that could be used to close up the story a little bit. But I didn't want to bring that up too much here because it's not on this.
Maybe they should make this like episode 5. You know,
Well, you know, depending on how this goes, I could see them doing a sequel to this now, you know, that it's been 15 years.
They're still together, I believe, right?
Yes.
Still,
So, Warp Riders marked a turning point for the Sword, proving that stoner metal could evolve beyond the Sabbath-worshipping roots and be more expansive and more conceptual. So, go check it out and pick it up at your local record store.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right, well, we've been gearing up for Record Store Day 2025. But in the meantime, anything else you're digging?
Yeah, I got a few things here in my yet-to-be-filled record crate. Mm. First one up for me is from hip-hop artist Larry June. He has a new album out entitled Life is Beautiful. This features The Alchemist in production and rapper 2 Chainz.
This sounds a lot like the plot of Warp Riders.
The Alchemist and 2 Chainz, I mean, 2 Chainz known for his like more popular trap rap style. Really adapts like a more traditional rap approach on this track here. I think combined with The Alchemist and Larry June, it's a really compelling listen. Let's hear Bad Choices. How you go from a misfit into a mogul. Yeah, I think The Alchemist just brings such a high level of quality and just dynamicism to his production that really makes the albums so much more interesting than usual, in my opinion. This is number 3 on my list for 2025 to date.
Wow, he's already ranking them. Good God, this guy's a professional.
And last one for me is from a London-born post-punk musician by the name of Heartworms. They have a new album out titled Glutton for Punishment. It's named after the 2017 Chainz album of the same name. Let's play the track Jacked. It's pretty dramatic, dark, driving record, lots of rich textures, sophisticated beats, and there's a vocal component to it as well. Number 6 on my list. So it's two pretty high ranking albums here in the last few weeks here for me.
Still early though.
Yeah. Still early. A long time ago. What you been digging on, Don?
Well, yeah, I've been, you know, again going back to, you know, a lot of post-punk bands who have new stuff coming out. So the band The Alarm has an album coming out June 6th called Transformation. If you haven't heard of them, they're a Welsh band formed in 1981. You know, their most known songs are 68 Guns or Rain in the Summertime. I always kind of thought of them as sort of like the Welsh U2. They kind of have like an arena rock style to them. Anyway, here's a single that will be on the album, Outlier. Beyond the data points,
I'm an outlier. Wow, it's much more robust than I was expecting.
Yeah. Wow, this guy's been around since the 80s?
Oh, yeah. Very emotive. The lead singer's Mike Peters. The album's a life-transforming endeavor of love, hope, and strength.
Don, correct me if I'm wrong. Back when that show Band Reunited was on VH1, weren't they one of the bands that got reunited?
Oh, they might have been. They could have been. There was a bunch like that on there. All right. And then another one comes from the Black Keys. They're back. The duo formed in 2001 by childhood friends Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney in Akron, Ohio. Their 13th studio album. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
I feel like they just came out a little while ago. Their next album's going to be called No Rain, No Flowers. No specific release date, but it is coming this year. Here's the track called Baby Girl.
Wow. They've really changed their sound. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Definitely sounds like the Black Keys. All right. Mm-hmm. How about you, dude?
All right. So a band that I've been enjoying for the last few years, Alien Weaponry, and their third album, Te Ra, a New Zealand metal band. This was just released March 28th. Continues their signature fusion of thrash and groove metal with traditional Maori culture, featuring songs performed both in English and Te Reo Maori. And this particular song we're going to listen to, it's called Mau Moko. It delves into the significance of traditional Maori face tattooing, known as Moko, and the cultural revival of this art following its near extinction during the colonization of New Zealand. It's a pretty dark story. Head trade comes into it. I don't want to get into the details, but some crazy stuff, and I really appreciate that they bring history to their music. So let's listen to a little bit of Mau Moko.
I first thought you said Mallory. I was like, oh, you know, from Family Ties.
No, yeah. Very culturally sensitive of you, Don. Once again, making me look good. Up next is from my vinyl collection, and because of Record Store Day, this is Mad Seasons Above from 1995. The vinyl copy I have is the 2013 Record Store Day reissue. They had a second disc with other tracks they recorded with Mark Lanegan on vocals. But Mad Season was formed in 1994 from Seattle music luminaries, including guitarist Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, John Baker Saunders, and Barrett Martin of Screaming Trees, and the vocalist Lane Staley of Alice in Chains, conceived as a side project with the intention of providing a supportive environment to help these members maintain their sobriety. They all had recently attended rehab and were trying to do something different to have something to focus on. Why don't we listen to a little bit of probably the most known song from the album, River of Deceit. After talking about the Jeremy single last time, that Mike McCready guitar work is very apparent to me there.
Bright and shimmery.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great English musician, Peter Gabriel.
He's pretty great.
Yeah. We had a conversation once, and he imparted this wisdom on me. He said, I was introduced to lots of great music through my local record store. It was a place where people knew music, and they knew me, and they could make great suggestions and discoveries. Whether it's in the physical world or online, the value of great knowledge and knowledgeable record store has not gone away.
Amen.
Couldn't agree more, Mr.
We're sort of a record store, right? We serve that role.
Yeah.
God, why is that? Always got to make it about us. Come on. It's about the music.
Sorry. All right. With that in mind, let's bring out my fun and yours, Wildbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
Roy Thomas Baker brought a larger-than-life sound to some of rock's biggest albums. Next time, you will be exploring records he produced, bold, theatrical, and brilliantly crafted works that showcase his legendary touch behind the boards.
Ah, the production work of Jonathan Taylor Thomas. Wait, what was it again?
Roy Thomas Baker.
Roy Thomas Baker. Sorry, RTB, not JTT.
Stones, Bowie, The Who, Nazareth, Mothers of Invention, T-Rex.
Oh boy.
Yep. That's a good 70s stuff, it sounds like. Awesome.
RTB ASAP. All right, well, what are you looking forward to for Record Store Day 2025? What's your favorite Roy Thomas Baker album? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds. Visit albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 285 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you, as always, for joining us here on the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next time with some RTB for you and me.
Thanks, listener. Bunny. Catch you next week.
You guys want to hear an outtake from Hindu love gods?
Ready? Let's go crazy. Woo-hoo. Let's get nuts. Woo-hoo.
Okay. So that was some Werewolves of London mixed in with Let's Go Crazy by Prince. Okay.
That's what I was going for.
Yeah. That would have been a smash hit. The love gods missed out.
Sorry, Prince. Sincere apologies.